been more on point with some of the things I'm going to talk about today. John mentioned it yesterday that math adds up, that some of us have to cover two congregations, and that's our task again today. Cover two congregations. We're going to be talking about Smyrna and Philadelphia. And these two congregations are connected by the idea that they are both told that they're going to have to go through some tribulation. Some sort of persecution is going to be happening. And so my hope, instead of covering, I'm going to tell you this. I told the high school class this, and I told the junior high class this, and I didn't make it either time, so we're going to find out. My goal is to cover both congregations the first hour and talk about persecution the second hour. We'll make it. But what usually has been happening is we get through one congregation the first hour and try to make it through the second, and some persecution the second hour. So we'll see. What I want us to do, I'm going to read the letter here to Smyrna. It's Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. It's a rather short letter. But I want to read the letter so that I can get what God says to them in your mind, and then we're going to talk about some of the history of the area and that city. And then we'll go from there. Starting with chapter 2, verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, "These things says the first and the last, he who was dead and come to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death." Okay. Smyrna, as near as I could find, if you don't like history, hang in with me, because Smyrna, as near as I could find, was founded, or the earliest records we have of a settlement there is around 3000 BC. So there is a lot of history with this town, a lot. They went through a lot as a community. It was settled around 3000 BC, but it didn't really become more than just a simple village until about 1000 BC when the Greeks began to expand eastward. I'm not going to do it here, but in the younger kids' classes, I had a map that I passed around. So if you've got a map in your Bible that shows these, if somebody nearby you doesn't, somebody might be interested in looking at it, but if you can imagine, and I'm gonna do it backwards so it's forward to you. If you can imagine Italy here, the boot of Italy, and then you've got Greece, and then over here is Turkey that curls around into Israel, into Palestine. And Smyrna is right on the coast of Turkey against Greece. And the spot of Smyrna puts it in a long inlet off the ocean. And large ships could get fairly close in that inlet, and it was calm and it was safe. So it became a shipping port right there in the heart of what we now call Turkey. And this shipping port would take things from the east, transfer them on a boat so they could get to Greece and Italy and Spain. And it would take things from Spain and Italy and Greece and put them on a caravan and send them east. So Smyrna was a fairly wealthy, fairly powerful city in the area. About the 7th century BC was kind of the height of its power and splendor. Some of you may have heard of a guy by the name of Homer. Remember Homer? Iliad and Odyssey. There is a lot of tradition that connects Homer with the town of Smyrna. They have found coins with an image of Homer on the coins, indicating their pride of him being from that area. There was a group of people that called themselves Homerians. They followed his teachings and his ideas. There is a cave near there. that most believe is where he did most of his writing. And there was even a temple that was called the Homerarium, where they actually had almost a worship of Homer and what he had done. About the 7th century B.C., they also built a temple to the goddess Athena in that city. A guy by the name of Alates II, Alates II. Don't ask me any more about him, I don't know. But he came through and conquered the city, and when he did that, he completely sacked it, he leveled it. Because of this, and because the Greeks didn't really come to their rescue very quickly, this city kind of cut all of its ties with Greece. It reorganized its politics into its own simple village system. And nothing really is heard about Smyrna except some little fragments of writings and inscriptions for quite a while, until about 334 BC when Alexander the Great comes through. Alexander the Great comes through like the conquering hero. He conquers the area, and he has read about and heard about the greatness of Smyrna once upon a time. And he decides it's going to be part of his job to rebuild this city. He rebuilds the city, and I want to read this part to you. The new city held temples, an acropolis, a gymnasium, a stadium, a theater, and a museum. Now, a lot of those things were common among many Greek cities. A museum was not necessarily that common. So this was a pretty important city. The streets were broad, well-paved, and laid out at right angles. Now, I know those of you from down in this area don't understand roads in right angles. But if you come out where I live, you've ever seen a picture of Kansas, most of Kansas, from the air, it looks like a big quilt. That's because when you're coming to my house, I can tell you to turn on a road and go 5 miles, and you can count the miles off by every road you go by. That's another mile. Because we're square. Okay? We plan ahead is what I think we do. And that's how they had built this city, but there was one street called the Golden Street. Most of the streets were named by Greek gods and goddesses, but one street called the Golden Street, this city is kind of on the foothills in the base of a mountain, and this one street called Golden Street, wide and broad, the main thoroughfare, curved. It did have a curve in it, and it went around the base of the mountain from east to west. An orator by the name of Aristides enjoyed describing it like a necklace on a statue when he saw it from afar. You can imagine this wide road cutting a swath around the base of this city. In 197 BC, the city suddenly cut ties with its king and decided it wanted to appeal to Rome for power and protection. They were a city that just turned themselves over to Rome, like we heard about yesterday. However, they hadn't had any ties with Rome, so they created a cult of Rome, they called it. And they built a temple, and they worshipped the goddess Roma. Have you heard of her? As a result of this, these people, this town of Smyrna, is often thought to be the originator of this worship of Rome and this worship of a goddess by the name of Roma. All right, let's see. We don't know when the church was started there. Smyrna is not really mentioned in any place, but if you look in Acts chapter 19, Paul is on his, what we often refer to as his third evangelistic journey. And along the way, let's see. In chapter 19, starting with verse 8, you remember there at Ephesus, Paul had begun teaching in the school of Tyrannus. Whether he just borrowed time or rented time, or they asked him to come in, I'm not sure, but he goes in there and he begins teaching. And if you look down in verse 10, this continued for 2 years, so that all who dwelt in Asia heard the word of the Lord Jesus, both Jews and Greeks. There's a really good chance that the Christians in the church at Smyrna started from this teaching in the school of Tyrannus somehow when Paul was in this area about this time frame. If that's true, estimate that there were approximately 10,000 people in the city at that time. This area, though, Smyrna had a very large Jewish contingent. There was a large Jewish population, and when Paul was in that area, there would have been a lot of synagogues. There are still, amazingly enough, there are still a number of fairly good-sized Jewish synagogues and a large Jewish population within this city. Eventually, a man by the name of Constantine, comes to power. And you remember one of the things he did was he moved his seat of authority from Rome to Constantinople. When he did that, the seat of power of the Roman government, instead of being west of Smyrna, ended up east of Smyrna, and their trade diminished. They weren't as important anymore, and the city began to decline. This city was ravaged several times. It was in an area that liked to be conquered. I'm going to kind of skip along. By the 14th century, Greek influence Greek influence and other influence was so strong in the area that the Turks called it Smyrna of the Infidels. That was the title they gave to it, because the Muslims were losing their foothold. About 1330, the Ottomans, the Turks, gained control of the area again, and with small exceptions have remained control under this time. From what I could find, this city has been destroyed, burnt to the ground, and rebuilt 5 times. The most recent being in 1922. This city was completely leveled. What happened there at the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire and the Allies signed what we know as the treaty, and I won't say this correctly, but if you're a historian, just yell what I'm supposed to say, and I'll say it the right way then. The Treaty of Sevres, S-E-V-R-E-S. Is that the way you say that? I couldn't find a pronunciation, and I'm not really a huge historian, so I wasn't sure. But when they signed this area, they agreed that this city of Smyrna would belong to the Greeks. Now you can imagine the Turks in the area didn't like that too much, and they proceeded to burn the city to the ground. The only part of the city that stayed untouched was those areas that were predominantly Muslim. But it has been rebuilt. 2010 estimates, remember when Paul was there, it was about 10,000 people. 2010 estimates put the population of what the town is now called Izmir, I-Z-M-I-R, Izmir, Turkey, at about 3.3 million. So it's become a huge metro complex again. Okay, history lesson's over. You can wake up if you're not interested in history. However, the reason I'm going through that history, both these churches, the history of the area is very key to some of the things that God tells them. They get some imagery, they get some ideas that is pretty important. Okay, Revelation chapter 2, let's look at it. I'm going to kind of skip over verse 8 a little bit. We understand, we've had enough of that to understand that this is Jesus writing it to a messenger, somebody that's going to give this message to the church there. So verse 9. Somebody show me where God criticizes this congregation. She tells them something they need to fix or do better. You see it? I don't see it. God does not criticize this congregation. He doesn't give them anything specific that they're supposed to fix or do better. Now, does that mean this is a perfect congregation? They don't have any problems whatsoever? No. John talked about that a little bit yesterday, and he did an excellent job of pointing out that there were people in that congregation, therefore there were issues. There were probably differences of opinion, there were probably personality conflicts, there were probably all kinds of different things that went on, just like goes on in our congregations today, but they didn't seem to have any false teachings, any major false doctrine, any major heart problems, nothing. So you're reading this letter. I want you to right now put yourself in the mindset of a member of the Church of Smyrna. And somebody gets up to read you this letter. I know your works, your tribulation, their poverty, but you're rich. I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but they are of the synagogue of Satan. Here's the Jews mentioned. You know they're there. But I find it interesting how God refers to them. He refers to them as the synagogue of Satan. Now, I thought about this a lot, because until I started looking at this lesson, I hadn't really put a lot of thought into what that might be discussing or describing. And I'm still not sure I'm 100% positive. It could mean several things. It could mean that they were literally gathering together in a synagogue and worshiping Satan. That could be the meaning, but I don't think that's probably what it was. Based on some Jewish history and things we see from the Jews, if they left the worship of God, they also left the synagogue. They left their people. They didn't gather with those people anymore. I have a feeling that it's an implication that they did not really have a true religion, even in Jewish sense. They were not following God, and therefore God considered them as following Satan. We should note that probably none of these Jews, if they were asked, would have said, oh yes, we don't follow God anymore, we follow Satan. They wouldn't have said that. They would have believed and been convinced that they were following God. Now that alone, from that verse, should be a warning for us, shouldn't it? We have to be careful. We may, if we're not watching ourselves and watching our doctrine and watching what we're doing within our congregation, it might be possible today, wouldn't it, for us to be feeling like or thinking like we're serving the Lord, and yet if we're not, God says, if you're not for me, you're against me. Remember what Jesus said to Peter when he was telling the disciples, I'm going to die, these things are going to happen, and Peter said, no, that is not going to happen, I'm not going to allow it. Remember what Jesus said to him? Get behind me, Satan. Peter didn't think he was following Satan. Peter had no idea. He thought he was doing what was right. But Jesus there equated what he was doing and how he was thinking with the actions and the thought processes of Satan himself. So that's a pretty good warning for us. We have to be careful, because if we're not for him, we're against him. If we're not for him, we're against him. Now, you're sitting here in Smyrna listening to this letter, and you've got this, oh yes, God knows we're going through a lot of things. God knows that we have these Jews that are causing us all these problems. And then you hear this, don't fear any of the things that you're going to suffer. If I was sitting there listening, that would perk my ears up a little bit. Because he already says they've been going through tribulation. They've already been dealing with things. They know what that is. And now he says, there's going to be some things coming, and don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, Jesus tells us, do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That's who we need to fear. So he's telling them, look, don't be afraid of what's going to happen. It doesn't really matter. That's not what's important. What's important, and he tells them later in verse 10, what's important is being faithful. Clear to the very end. Don't give up. Don't quit. Like Randy was talking about this morning. Interestingly enough, God identifies who is behind all of this. Now, he's already brought up the synagogue of Satan, but is that who he says is behind this future persecution that's going to come? Nope. He identifies the source. He doesn't identify the tool. He identifies the source. He identifies the fact that it is going to be Satan, the synagogue of Satan. These people that are following Satan, they are going to be the ones that are persecuting you, but I want you to focus on Satan. Ephesians 6, verse 12, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. We wrestle against those powers that are behind what the flesh and blood is doing. Another thing I want you to notice is that this persecution is going to have a purpose. What is the purpose of this persecution? To test them. To test them. I ask a question in both the high school and the junior high class, and I was quite pleased at the answers I received. So those of you that have children in those classes, They're getting a handle on this, and I think it's a good thing. I asked them, what's the difference between a temptation and a test? Anybody want to give that a shot? They did a pretty good job of answering it in lots of different ways. Here's how I look at it. A temptation is when Satan is trying to get me to do something I shouldn't do, something God doesn't want me to do. A test is when God tries to see if I will do what I'm supposed to do. And there's a difference. God is never going to try to get me to do something wrong. God does not tempt anyone. That's what we're told. But he allows Satan to test us. And sometimes he tests. Remember with Abraham and Isaac. He said, I'm going to test Abraham. I'm going to see if he'll do what he's supposed to do. So here they're going to be tested. And this test is going to have a purpose. In Matthew chapter 13, I'm going to turn there. In Matthew chapter 13, Jesus gives us the parable of the soils, or the parable of the sower, whichever way you want to view it. I think both are appropriate. And you remember that parable, the sower is going around scattering seed, and there's all kinds of different seed that it lands on. I want you to notice verse 20. Stony ground, you remember the stony ground? What did the seed do in the stony ground? It rose up, it grew, but then the sun hit it, and it died. Because it didn't have any root system. Verse 20. But he who received the seed on the stony places, this is he who hears the word, and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately stumble. See, that's what God is doing here. God's going to test him because he perhaps perceives or knows that there are some members of this congregation that they're just not rooted. And this test, this persecution is going to do one of two things. It's either going to knock them off the fence, and they're either going to stop serving him, which if they weren't solid and secure, their heart wasn't really in it in the first place, or it's going to reinforce what they're able to withstand and their strength. I was recently in Brookfield, Missouri, and staying with Brother D.D. Russell. Now, he has a stand of trees next to the road, and they had some of those, it's kind of a mixture. There's some big pine trees, and there's some trees that are, I don't know what kind they are. Daryl's here, maybe he knows. But there's some trees that are, they're just a long trunk with some leaves at the top. That's all there is. And these were all growing together. Well, some of the evergreens died. So they cut those out. Cut all those evergreens out. And when the first or second big wind came along, one of those trees just bent clear over, and he now has a tree that's shooting right toward the road because it had never been tested. It had leaned on all those other trees for its support and protection, and it had never been tested itself. And when it was tested, it failed. It bent. Now, there's other trees just like it that were tested the same way, and they're standing. They're perfectly tall and straight and look good because their roots are better. God tests us for a purpose. He tests us so that our roots will grow deeper. So that our roots will grow deeper. Jill and I had the experience of when we were young married, that we, because of where my job took me, we moved to an area that had a small congregation that we didn't know very well. We started attending with them and everything was going fine, until somebody in the congregation knew an individual that they wanted to come in and be the preacher there. And when he came in, he began teaching some things, not necessarily publicly, like we were talking about the other day. He wasn't saying things from the pulpit necessarily that I could disagree with, but some of the things he believed and talked about privately with people were just wrong. Well, we had some decisions to make. But I didn't want to go talk to him and have to say, look, this this stuff you're talking about, this stuff you're doing, it's not right. And him say, why is it wrong? And me say, well, because that's what I've always been taught. To me, that wasn't going to hold water. So what did I have to do? Jill and I had to sit down with our Bibles and study and figure out why it was we believed what we believed and be able to back it up and defend it. And once I could do that, then myself and another member of the church there approached him and confronted him. What did that test do? I probably studied more in that month or so than I'd studied for years. Tests strengthen us. Tests do things for us. And they're going to be tested, and there's going to come something after that test, isn't there? There's going to be a reward. After they make it through this trial, there is going to be a reward. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Let's talk about the 10 days for a minute. As near as I could figure, and I read through it several times because I was afraid maybe I'd missed something, and if I still have, let me know. I think this is the first time in the book of Revelations that we get a time period. Now, in the book of Revelation, we know a couple of things. Very rarely, if at all, are the time periods literal. They seem to be representative of something. One of the things we like to do is we like to use the year for a day concept. If you're not familiar with that, the idea is that, like here, we'll just use the 10. God says 10 days, you'll suffer tribulation. The prophecy part is 10 days. The reality part is 10 years. 1 year for each day. We get that from a lot of places. One of the places you'd be most familiar is with the children of Israel when they came off of Sinai, came over to the land, and were supposed to go in. They sent the 12 spies in. 12 spies came back. 10 of them said, we can't do it. 2 of them said, yes, we can. God said, you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Why did he pick 40 years? He tells us, one year for every day that the spies were in the land. Now, that's just one place that we make that connection, okay? And there's others. And we can talk about that another time, probably. I don't want to get too much into that. I think this 10 years probably means one of two things, and I'm not sure we can be sure of either one 100%. It either means 10 years, and we stick with that day or year, or it means a short period of time. It's not going to be long. 10 years in the span of things isn't that big of a deal. I asked the junior high class, how long does 10 years feel like? Much of the majority of most of their lives. And then I told them that 10 years to me, it's a long time, but I can wrap my arms around that and it's okay. And I used him without permission, but then I said, how long do you think 10 years feels like to Tom Dennis? Not that long, right, Tom? And it's gone. Boom. 10 years really in the large span of things isn't that big of a deal. Isn't that long. So it could be a literal 10 years, and it could be just a short span of time. But whatever it is, John writes here at the Spirit's command that there's going to be tribulation, and this is going to be under the Roman government by this time period, and Roman imprisonment usually meant a Roman death most of the time. Not every time, but most of the time. How many of you are familiar with a guy by the name of Polycarp? You ever read about him? He may be one of the most notable members of this congregation at Smyrna, at least as near as we can find and figure, I think. Some believe he may have been an elder there. I don't know. Anecdotal evidence, I couldn't find any more than just that, just stories. But we know some things about Polycarp. We know that he died at the hands of the Romans, don't we? And there are a lot of accounts. I don't know why this individual got so much attention, but there's a lot of people that wrote narratives about his death and what happened. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to read to you, it's basically a mixture of all these accounts. I took all the things from the different accounts I looked at that were the same or similar across the accounts. In the face of many witnesses, a truth can be born. And so I'm hoping that they all got it right. The things that just one person said, none of the rest of them talked about, I didn't include. Now, that doesn't mean all of this is absolutely 100% factually true, but I think it's fairly close. Okay. The time is about 166 A.D., which would be about 70 years after the writing of this letter. Polycarp would have been a young boy of maybe 10, give or take, 10 years old when the church at Smyrna received this letter, and he would have heard it read before the church. Okay. The first thing we must recognize is that the Jews of this area were very instrumental in his arrest and trial. They created a mob scene outside the court that the proconsul was inclined to listen to. That sound familiar? We had that happen with Paul. We had that happen with Christ. Many others. He was asked to recount his belief in Christ, to which he responded, 86 years I have served him, and he never once wronged me. How then shall I blaspheme my king who has saved me? At which point he was told by the proconsul that wild beasts would be released. Remember, that was one of the ways the Romans liked to kill people. Throw the starving lions or bears or tigers out into the arena and let them rip somebody apart. At which point he told the proconsul, let him loose. Go ahead. The ruler then asked him to offer incense in worship to the Roman emperor. Remember that Rome worship, the goddess Roma? Participate in this, and I will let you go. He responded, since you still vainly strive to make me swear by the fortune of Caesar, as you express it, affecting ignorance of my real character, hear me frankly declaring what I am. I am a Christian. And if you desire to learn the Christian doctrine, assign me a day and you will hear. So he basically responds to him and says, look, you're not paying attention. I'm a Christian. I'm not going to do any of this stuff you want me to do. Now, if you want to know what it means to be a Christian, invite me back and I'll tell you. He invites the proconsul to have a Bible study. I found that interesting. The proconsul then threatened to tame him with fire. Remember, that was another way they would do it. Tie him to a stake, put some wood around the base of it, light it on fire and burn them. Polycarp responded, you threaten me with fire, which burns for an hour and is soon extinguished, but the fire of the future judgment and of eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly, you are ignorant of. But why do you delay? Do whatever you please. All the accounts, every account that I read, had this following enactment of what happened. They tied him to the stake, they put the wood around him and attempted to light the fire. The fire would burn a little bit and kindle up, but it would not blaze. It would not get large enough that it would catch him on fire and burn him. They tried repeatedly to get the fire to go, and they could not get it stoked. We've all experienced that around camp this week, haven't we? Okay, I've seen the smoke. Okay, they couldn't get it going. The Roman soldiers that were surrounding him rushed him all at once, and they all thrust him through with their swords pretty much simultaneously. And the reports were that the amount of blood that came out of his body at that point extinguished whatever little fire was at the base of the pole. Polycarp would have been in one of these little classes back here if he'd been in our group today. 10 years old, give or take. He heard this letter. He'd probably heard it discussed. He'd heard it talked about. He'd heard it referred to. He saw the persecution that perhaps his parents had to go through, perhaps his grandparents had to go through. He saw all these things happening, and when it came his time to stand up for what he believed and who he was he faithful unto death? I believe he was. I believe he was. Why? Well, in verse 11, God brings up a concept of the second death. There's two deaths. There's a physical death, and then there's something else. There's a spiritual death. And that physical death, while it may be painful, depending on why we die or how we die, it may be a long, protracted, painful ordeal. But in the grand scheme of things, it is but, what did Paul call it? A light affliction. A short time. And after that, then we get assigned either spiritual life or spiritual death. And God says, choose life. Overcome, and you will not be hurt by the second death. Overcome this, go through this, be faithful unto death, and you will only die once, not twice. Okay, I'm going to pause here, because that ends Smyrna. That's the fastest I ever got through it in any of the other classes. And pause and see if there are any questions or comments about this congregation or some of the things that we've talked about. Oh no, I scan it back in the back.
Was there other instances in any of these letters, especially this one, that would give us prophecy? I'm kind of questioning the idea of the 10 days literally versus 10 years. Touch on that just a little bit again.
A little bit. I didn't really come with a lot of the references, and I don't have them memorized for that. As you look through and try to interpret the book of Revelation, there are time periods that if we leave them in days, doesn't make sense. But if we put them in a year equal to those days, the time reference, the time stamp fits. There was, somebody may have to help me out with the reference. I believe it was Jeremiah that was asked to roll over. Ezekiel. Does anybody know the passage on that? I should have wrote that down and I didn't. It might be chapter 4. Yeah, Ezekiel chapter 4. Yeah, I want to start with verse 4. He says, "Lie also on your left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of days that you lie on it. You shall bear their iniquity, for I have laid on you the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. When you have completed them, you will lie again on your right side, and then you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have laid on you a day for each year." So there's another time where God used that. He told him to lay on his side for so many days, and that's going to determine the number of years that Israel is going to suffer. Does that help at all? Okay. Okay. That's why I said I'm not 100% positive that we can put the day to a year here. I couldn't find anything in the history. Well, first of all, if the dating is right and all the account of Polycarp and some others that are in that area and the timing of their persecution and death, it was a lot longer than 10 years. So I just have a feeling that it's supposed to just mean it's going to be a short period of time and not a definite period of time. Is that what you were looking for? I couldn't find anything in the history that helped me decide, one way or the other, an exact time period for this persecution. Now, maybe some others in the group have some ideas, but I don't.
I think that's good. That one of the guidelines we follow is take a passage literally, unless you can't do that. And if we can't find a historical 10 days, then it may mean something else. Besides the day for a year, it can also be a figure of speech and a symbolic number to represent trial. Pharaoh got 10 plagues. the Lord said that Israel had tempted him 10 times in the wilderness, and we suspect it was probably more than that. Jacob's wages were changed 10 times. I think those were figures of speech, meaning several times. Right. And that may be what's here, is that you'll be tempted for 10 days, meaning enough to show that you are faithful.
Right. You're going to know it's happening, yeah. And it's going to happen over and over.
I had another comment, too, on this Satan is interesting. Satan and verse 9 in King James is capitalized, and then devil in verse 10 is not capitalized. Devil's capitalized then in chapter 20. So I wonder if it as you were explaining, I think your explanation was right, synagogue of Satan may not refer to the person Satan, but those who are opposing him, which is in line with Satan meaning adversary.
Right.
Whereas devil meaning an accuser. I don't know why they didn't capitalize that here, but...
Mine's not either.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
So, anyway, the idea of opposition and accusation, things like that would be used to oppose the church.
Right. Very good. Back here somewhere?
Doug, Eric Owens, Prince Road. I've got an editorial note in my Bible that indicates that Smyrna was host to athletic games of an Olympic sort, in which case it would have been a festival, potentially, you know, a week, 2 weeks, say, maybe even 10 days. I don't know. But I wonder if it might not be, this might not be a reference in regards to the testing and the crown of life in regards to the laurels that would have been offered to the champion of the games, Smyrna, where this is going to go on, potentially for a while, but I wonder if this might not be an allusion to that, not unlike what we've heard throughout the week, is there were allusions to, you know, what was culturally going on, what might not be meaningful to the people there, and
right.
it might not be a reference to that.
It very well could be. One of the things I find the most interesting is there may be things written to many of these churches that we can't ever possibly completely understand the way they would have understood it. Just like, I can talk about certain things and use an example perhaps in here that somebody from California or New York might not comprehend. They might not understand. Just because of cultural differences or something that triggers a memory or an idea that means something to them that it might not mean to somebody else. So, yeah, there could be a lot in here that we don't completely understand, and I can see that connection. Yep. Anything else? Up here in front. Well, everybody can't hear you. Well, I'd rather let you say it the first time than I misrepeat it.
I just want to know, is there still a church there? Is there any, you said that there was still a big city there.
There's a huge city
2010.
There. 2010. I could not find anything on the internet about a church, a Christian group in Smyrna that we would recognize as the early church. Okay, like us. There are some Christian influence, well, I should say this right now, because I'm going to get to it later. Sometimes when I'm using the word Christian, I'm using it in what the world views as a Christian, which means I know this is the Bible, and I think God had something to do with something, which is like the really generic Christian concept. And there are some groups there that profess Christianity. What I could find, they're not big, like we're used to seeing in the States. They're very much, this is very heavily Muslim area, that part of Turkey. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. So if they're there, they're underground enough that they don't publicize for sure. You're not going to find a website for the church in Smyrna. Well, Izmir.
We were studying Revelation about a month ago, and I Googled Izmir, and there were Christians being persecuted still there today.
Yes.
And there have just been some killings and harassment of Christians by the Muslims.
Part of some of the research I did, and we'll hopefully get to some of this in the second hour, is they asked me to talk about persecution in the world of Christians today, both overseas and in the U.S., and well, it doesn't take you very long to find it, and I did find those accounts in Izmir, which is why I say I know there's a Christian presence there, but I couldn't find, like, sizes of groups or exact names or anything like that. Did we have something else? Okay. We are going to keep moving. We're going to go to the congregation at Philadelphia. Now, when did I say that, at least as far as I could find, Smyrna, that area anyway, it wasn't called that at the time, but that area was established as a community. Remember how long ago? About 3000 BC. It could have been before that, we don't know, but about 3000 BC. The history on Philadelphia doesn't take nearly as long. The earliest recorded settlement in that spot that I could find was about 189 BC. That's, all things considered, that's fairly recent. That's less than 200 years before Christ was born. So that's not very old. So I'm going to go ahead and this time I'm going to go ahead and read the history first. Okay? I'm going to read the history first. This township, this area, was established in 189 BC by King Eumenes II of Pergamon. Now, King Eumenes II had a brother, a younger brother, Attalus II, who idolized his older brother. He idolized him and loved him and was around him so much that he had earned the nickname Philadelphos, which literally means one who loves his brother. That's what everybody called him. That's the guy that loves his brother. It was so obvious. And so when King Eumenes established this town and founded it, he named it after the nickname of his brother, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. We have Philadelphia in the U.S., don't we? Now, however, Attalus II had a son, Attalus III, but Attalus III had no children. So as he was dying, he bequeathed all of his land, all of his empire, including this city, to his wonderful Roman allies. So you went to bed, if you lived in Philadelphia, you went to bed under the rule of King Attalus III, and you woke up, and congratulations, you're a Roman citizen subject to the empire. Because your king just gave you away, gave you over. That happened about 133 BC. Now, if you look at a map, or if you look at pictures of this area, it looks like an ideal place to put a city. There's wonderful grasslands, there's rolling hills and some mountain area. It looks beautiful, but there's a problem. It's built on the edge of extinct volcanoes. So the reason they have lots of good grassland is there's lots of volcanic ash and cinder that leads to good growth. Earthquakes have also been very, very frequent in the area. There was a huge one that was noted. They don't know the Richter scale measurement of it, but it was noted in AD 17 that destroyed Philadelphia along with 11 other cities nearby. So an earthquake large enough that it leveled 12 cities. That's pretty good size. Strabo, who was a Greek geographer, wrote in some of his writings that frequent aftershocks often threw the people of Philadelphia into a panic. Can you imagine? Your city's been leveled, you go back in, try to rebuild, and everything starts shaking again. Consequently, people lived in a constant state of fear and often remained outside of the city, living in huts or tents all across the area. So this city went from a city to an area. because not very many people wanted to live inside the city gates. Those that were brave enough to remain in the city practiced various techniques to support and strengthen the walls and houses against aftershocks. During the rebuilding, now see if this sounds familiar, during the rebuilding, the Emperor Tiberius relieved the city of having to pay taxes. Does that sound familiar? Didn't we just do that not too long ago with New Orleans and the areas in Louisiana, and we do that sometimes with other places? In fact, I think it was just recently that they had to start paying their income tax again down there. Tiberius said, you don't have to pay any more taxes to the Roman government. Use that money to rebuild your city. How do you suppose the citizens responded to that? They were very grateful. Very grateful. In fact, they granted honors to Tiberius, built a temple in his honor. They began their own imperial cult, worship of Rome. And they had coins that bore the name. We have coins that bear words, right? What are some of the words that are on our money? In God we trust. E pluribus unum. We have all kinds of different words on our coinage and money. On some of their coins, they had the word neocoron. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that's as close as I'm going to get. Which literally means temple sweeper and would have indicated a caretaker of the temple. So on their money, they said, we are caretakers of the temple in honor of Tiberius who helped us out. All that remains of that city, that was rebuilt, Roman Philadelphia, all that remains is a small theater on the top of one hill. That's all that's left. There's no actual city. There is a modern city nearby that most people believe are the descendants. Many of them that settled that city are the descendants of the people that left there, finally gave up, and founded another city close by. That city, if you look for it on a map, is called Al-Sahir, A-L-A-S-E-H-I-R, Turkey, which translated means City of God. And that city, the closest population I could get for today was about 37,000. That's it. Not a lot of history there. Not a lot of history there. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop at that history, and it's time for our break, right? We'll take our break, 30-minute break, and when we come back, we'll dig into the letter to Philadelphia.